I'm George Liston, CA. Allow me to begin this conversation on a personal note. My great-grandmother died in Muscatine, Iowa, in June of 1910. Here are the concluding lines of her obituary. She was born in Virginia a slave. When 22 years of age, she escaped through the Underground Railway to Canada and lived there until after the war when she settled in Muscatine. She leaves one daughter and one son. Throughout my life, I've wondered about hers, about the captivity from which she fled and the reality from which she could never escape. But curiosity about one man's ancestor is but a small part of a much larger story, the story of slavery in America. My guests are James Oliver Horton and Lois E. Horton, co-authors of Slavery and the Making of America. Lois and Jim Horton, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me say this about the book right from the start. You've written an epic story, and I think we could call it a continuing narrative because it brings us not just through slavery, but through the themes of slavery, which still play out in our own time. And I'd like to play a bit with that very statistic. By my calculation, the slavery that you depict in the book, beginning in 1619 to 1865, lasted 246 years. Mm-hmm. And I think, by any calculation, America's commitment to independence and democracy, 1776 to now, is but 229 years. Hence, slavery is the larger, at least numerical, American experience. One could say this country's been a slaveocracy for longer than it's been a democracy. That, however, doesn't seem to me to be as well depicted in our history as one might suspect. The weight of slavery, the importance, the centrality, if you will, of slavery. Let me begin with you, Jim. I'd like your comment on that, and if that played a role in your writing this book and how you wrote this book.
Well, it certainly did. In fact, you can understand that simply by looking at the title of the book, Slavery and the Making of America. And our point there was that slavery was a central part of the making of this country. One of the things that Americans, and I think most people in the world, take for granted was that slavery was an institution that was certainly present in America, but not central to what America became. Mm-hmm. In reality, slavery was the central point of much of America's economy, much of the formation of America's political system and the political positions within that system. And slavery helped to shape the culture that became American culture.
I think actually there have been two stories going along in America's history. And some people remembered the story of slavery and that experience. The other story that everyone learned in school was the story of freedom and democracy and the celebration of America. And part of what we can do, I think, with this book is bring these two stories together right into some kind of conversation.
Lois, one of the things that's fascinating from the book is the time it took to define what we came to know as slavery. By that I mean, if you look at the 17th century, I guess, well, 1619 onward, those years, slaves imported from Africa, indentured servants coming from Europe, were very much, I understood, of a kind. But that over the next 100 years, there'd be some very drastic definition going on.
It was almost developed on an ad hoc basis. Slavery has a very long history in the world, of course, mm-hmm. and many, many different peoples were slaves. The word comes from Slav, so the Eastern Europeans were slaves in the ancient world as well. And when we get to American slavery, the thing that sets American slavery apart from all those other slaveries is that it was based on race.
Right.
And that develops gradually. Uh-huh. And so there are people who come in who are Africans who come in and serve for a term and then are freed and manage to acquire land and all of this. But in historical terms, in a relatively short time, we begin to develop this difference between white indentures right and African slaves.
And when we do, it's with a vengeance, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, there's really important distinctions to be made between the first and second generation of those bound servants mm-hmm. who are certainly unfree. But they're not slaves in the sense that their grandparents will be slaves.
Right.
As Lois said, some of them serve for a period of time. You will find them in many ways doing very similar things and on an equal plane with white indentured servants. Now, there's an important distinction between indentured servitude and slavery. Indentured servants generally became indentured servants because of their own choice.
Right.
Generally, you became an indentured servant because you sold your time in return for, most often, passage to America.
Right.
And then you would serve out a period of time, mainly 7 years or so. And then after that, you'd be free.
Yeah.
Whereas slavery, as it was developing, was increasingly perpetual.
Exactly.
And inherited.
A couple of themes that run throughout the book. You actually touched on one of them, Jim, and that is, quote, as I put it, the profound contradiction between a nation seeking its liberty and denying it to others. And let me get you to comment on this second theme, Lois. Slaves as resistors, not just as going along with this, but right from the start, and there's a continual pattern of this.
You mentioned earlier that it took the enlistment of the entire society to maintain slavery, and I think that is one clue.
Mm-hmm.
People did resist slavery from the very first. When they hit the shore, they began to resist. And it took then an amazing mobilization of slaveholders and people in the towns and all to keep those people in slavery, because they resisted in hundreds of different ways. And really the story of slavery in America from the perspective of the enslaved people is the story of resistance.
Absolutely.
Whether it's running away or work stoppages, strikes, there's a broad range of resistance.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important to understand the extent to which African Americans resisted this institution of slavery and the variety of ways that they did it. As Lois said, we all think of running away. We think of passive resistance. We think of outright rebellion. And
not
we had all of that. But beyond that, for example, at the time of the American Revolution, slaves petitioned the colonial government saying to them, you people are fighting for your freedom. You appreciate human freedom. We do too.
Mm.
We deserve freedom as you are fighting for yours. That's a kind of resistance. I mean, the fact is that they used America's principles as stated in our founding documents, you know, the Declaration, the Constitution, and so on. Mm-hmm. They used those principles over and over again, trying to, if nothing else, embarrass America into doing the right thing.
Well, that's an excellent point. And it leads me to say, let's flip the coin, because if we're talking about resistance on the one side, there's rationalization on the other. You know, how a country that still emphasizes its religious roots, so to speak, in a variety of ways, and a country dedicated through eloquent language to the Enlightenment principles of freedom. How do you do this with a people?
You know, and here is, I think, a central feature in the long-standing effect of this institution of slavery. This freedom-loving nation had a difficult time trying to justify being a lover of freedom and holding other people in slavery. And so one of the things that it starts to do very early on, and Thomas Jefferson is implicated in this, it starts to speculate about the possibility of these particular people being held in this particular kind of unfreedom being different. Perhaps race makes them different and therefore less suitable for freedom. And this racial theory that starts to grow is important and grows because this is one way that the nation can rationalize that which is in reality irrational.
Indeed. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guests are James Oliver Horton and Lois E. Horton, co-authors of Slavery and the Making of America. Lois, one of the fascinating parts of this book is, well, it's American history, and American history is full of battles and wars and fights and struggles and to this day. And blacks are in every one of them. And even in the Revolution, which is ironic when you think about it, and one of the figures I took from the book was that blacks were 20% of the fighting forces, that is both the American and British combined, but 20% is quite substantial. Many of them cited for heroism. All of that leads to, a comment that I'm going to give and ask you for a comment back from it. But despite all of that, in the face of all that, you get recurrent charges of cowardice and reluctance to fight from that point, almost to this one, if you think up to Tuskegee Airmen, a reluctance even to use black troops in the Civil War until their hand is forced. And maybe the other side of that is a constant fear of black rebellion because of Haiti. So on the one hand, we've got this aspersion that blacks are too cowardly to fight. On the other hand, they may fight and kill us all. I mean, it's just the most incredible kind of duality.
We're back to Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah,
again,
I think
actually.
So. Because Thomas
Jefferson, mm-hmm. when he knew that slavery was wrong, but he couldn't see any way out because he feared revenge. Mm-hmm. You know, he put himself in the place of the slaves and said, you know, that if freed, they can't stay here because they would seek revenge. And the miraculous thing was that generally that wasn't true. The question of blacks fighting in the wars, they fought in every war. They were Minutemen. And they were Minutemen in the beginning battles of the Revolution. And yet when George Washington comes in to be the general of the forces, of the Continental Forces, he says, no more black people can enlist. Mm-hmm. And how frustrating it must have been for people who fought in the Revolution and then in the War of 1812, some did both, to find their bravery being questioned every single war.
Yeah.
And I think you may be right that there's a fear of arming black people who have a grievance.
Right. Yeah.
And you have to understand that African Americans understood this. It wasn't as if they didn't know that their ancestors had fought in the Revolution or the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. Of course they knew. You know, 1852, this a black historian in Boston, William C. Nell, writes a book called The Colored Patriots of the American Revolution. What he does in this book is to tell the story of his ancestors and ancestors of lots of the people he knew personally who fought in the war that brought the nation into existence. And so when people would ask the question in the Civil War, as they did, will the Negro fight? African Americans, including Frederick Douglass, would say, this is a stupid question.
Lois, the book covers not only a vast amount of time, but a vast amount of territory. And moving right ahead, as we say in radio, as we come into the 19th century, I was really fascinated by this pivotal century, which, of course, includes the Civil War, which is a linchpin event. But my shorthand for it, and I guess this is the question, Lois, to see if I got some understanding, was that manifest destiny was playing itself out in the American character, spreading westward and all of that. And as that century developed, there were some regional distinctions in the slavery question that were very, very notable. For example, in New England, it seemed to me abolitionary fervor was growing very strong. In the West, what we called the West at that time, the westward expansion was a zone of contention, bloody contention in many ways. And the South was getting adamant, increasing, massively, violently defiant. Are those?
Yes. There's actually a point in around 1830 when the integrated abolition movement is gaining a great deal of attention, 1831, when William Lloyd Garrison starts publishing his newspaper, mm-hmm. and the South is feeling more and more defensive. Mm-hmm. They know they don't have the principle on their right. side. They begin to develop an argument of that slavery, instead of a necessary evil, which had been an argument before, was now a positive good. And this is a very destructive kind of argument because it argues that black people need slavery to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And this echoes through the 20th century, in fact. And so what's happening is this, they're contending over what the future of the country will be. It's where will slavery exist? Will it exist in that West that the country is moving into? Mm-hmm. That's really the future of the country, whether it will have compensated laborers who are free
right.
or slave labor. And you can, we know the Civil War comes, so it's hard mm-hmm. to read naively, but you can see the war coming as it becomes more and more contentious
right.
And harder to compromise.
Yeah. Cotton, too.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. you're absolutely right, because mm-hmm. what I was about to say is that at the same time this is happening, that is the same time that the abolition movement is beginning to build in the North and becoming a movement that has some powerful white advocates as well as African Americans. At the same time, slavery is becoming more powerful in the South. It's becoming more important. First of all, the South is expanding from the East Coast, upper South of the colonial period. That is the Virginia, Maryland, Chesapeake Bay region, and the Carolinas. It is now moving southward and westward. And now the new territories are opening up. I'm talking about Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. These areas are opening up, and these are becoming the fertile fields for the growing of cotton. And cotton is becoming incredibly valuable, and it is providing more and more the economic underpinning for Southern civilization.
Yeah, absolutely.
And becoming important in the nation as a whole.
That movement of cotton west occasions then a whole internal slave trade. And I think that's the hardest thing to write about and to read about, too, because what you have is the disruption, the breaking up of families and communities, a million people being moved from the upper south, the east coast.
Let me toss my two cents in. You two were the authors. I was the reader. And that really was the part that probably gripped me most in a way, because first of all, on the importance of cotton, the book points out that cotton alone as a crop, as an industry, as an industrial statistic, was worth more than everything else the country produced.
Sure.
Together.
Yeah, exactly. By 1840, cotton as an export is more valuable than everything else the nation exported put together. Now, what that does is provide not only economic power for the South, but increasingly political power.
Right.
You know, in that 72 years between the election of George Washington and the election of Abraham Lincoln, 50 of those years sees a slave holder as president of the United States.
That's right.
And during that 72-year period, not a single person who is ever elected to a second term as president is not a slaveholder. Now, that gives you some sense of the political power of the South that comes out of its economic power. And slavery is incredibly valuable. On the eve of the Civil War, the dollar value of slaves in the United States is greater than the dollar value of all of America's railroads, all of America's banks, all of America's manufacturing put together.
That, in turn, makes it, and my shorthand was, slavery, that is, a major domestic enterprise. I mean, this is really, because this is the most powerful machine around.
No sideshow in American society. It was the main event.
The main event. And so we get phrases, I mean, some are still common in our language. Being sold down the river was literal. You could be sold down to Southern slavery from, say, Virginia or someplace, and where it was even more brutal, the cruelest.
Sure. And where you were more valuable.
And everyone, maybe not everyone, but people should know the phrase the Middle Passage, which is the original transport from Africa to this country, which was brutal in its own right. This phase was also called the Second Middle Passage because of the brutality of that thing.
And because it broke up families.
Yeah.
You know, and people were isolated. They were sent down away from their families, their communities.
Let me, however briefly, get a sense from you both of a moment and a man. The moment, it was actually just prior to the Civil War, 1850, of the Fugitive Slave Law. And, I mean, it's hard to say where the low point is here, but what do you think the impact? How would you place that in terms of its centrality to our story?
The Fugitive Slave Law?
Yeah, what did it do?
I think the Fugitive Slave Law was indeed a turning point. It was a turning point in many ways. First of all, the Fugitive Slave Law came as a part of this compromise of 1850. The compromise of 1850 was part of a long string of compromises that the nation had to indulge in to try to hold itself together as it was becoming increasingly partly a nation of free labor and partly a nation of slave labor. And as slavery was growing increasingly powerful in the South was becoming increasingly demanding. You know, by the 1850s, you know, the South was trying to push into Cuba, trying to move into parts of Latin America. It was trying to grow in terms of the places where it could expand its slavery. So that this compromise of 1850 was an effort to try once again. They had tried, and at the time of the Constitution, they had tried through the 1820s, all through the decades before the Civil War. 1850, they try again. Let's try to calm this growing conflict between free labor and slave labor. The Fugitive Slave Law was a nod in the direction of the South to say to the powerful slaveholders in the South, the nation will help you protect your property in ways that will go beyond the original fugitive slave law. You know, the original fugitive slave law in the 1790s had been on the book, and in fact, there had been a fugitive slave provision in the Constitution itself, right. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, in the Constitution it says that if you owe service in one state, you can't escape that service by removing yourself to another state. Well, this fugitive slave law in 1850 was the most harsh fugitive slave law in American history.
And a major concession to the South.
And it was pivotal, I think, in a way, an unintended consequence. It strengthened the fugitive slave law, but it did so by making it impossible for people to be neutral in the North.
This,
you
yes.
Know, you, if you were a bystander and did not help capture a fugitive from slavery when you were called upon to by the officials, you could be jailed and you could be fined. I mean, a substantial fine, $1,000 and 6 months in jail. Yeah. So you could no longer be neutral. You had to take a side.
And it was the extreme of denial of human rights. You know, you could be accused of being a fugitive slave. You had no right of self-defense. Mm-hmm. You had no right to a lawyer. You had no right to a jury trial. You are presumed to be a fugitive.
Yeah, you could not testify.
Exactly.
It's interesting. I mean, you speak very, very powerfully to the political concession it represented and to the outrage it provoked, which I think is... The man, obviously, was the man of the moment. And once again, we can't do justice to even this question in the time that we have. And that, of course, is Abraham Lincoln, who's... and I'm now moving ahead, obviously, to the war years, his election and the war that followed. The Lincoln that comes forth in this book is a very complex person, to say the least.
Yeah, the Lincoln that lived was a very complex person.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, I have been asked this question about how I feel about Lincoln. And I'll tell you, I think that there's a good argument to be made that Lincoln was our greatest president. And I don't use the word great loosely. What I am talking about is that he showed the capacity for personal growth. If you listen to the speeches and read some of the letters that Abraham Lincoln wrote in the 1840s and 1850s, he has very definite ideas about race, which are pretty standard for his time. He's a racist. Okay? In 1854, he gives a speech in Peoria, Illinois, in which he says, "If I had all the power in the world, I would not know what to do about this institution of slavery." He never liked slavery. But he didn't think that the federal government especially had any right to attack slavery, private property, directly. Now, if you compare that speech with his second inaugural, which was in 1864, he stands up and he says, among other things, he says, "You know, it may be that God is punishing us for slavery." He says, "It may well be that God won't be satisfied until the last drop of blood drawn by the sword," he's talking about the war here, mm-hmm. "matches that drawn by the lash," that is mm-hmm. slavery before the war. And the last speech he ever gives in his life is a speech he gives in 65 when he says how appreciative he is of the service rendered by African Americans in the war in saving the Union. And he then goes on to say, "We need to move to a point where African Americans can become voters, can become full citizens." And don't forget that he is saying this, and the Supreme Court ruling is still in effect. That is, the Supreme Court, which said blacks cannot be citizens.
Mm-hmm.
John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of Abraham Lincoln, hears that speech and says to a friend of his, "That's the last speech that man will ever make." And not too long after that, within a matter of weeks, John Wilkes Booth assassinates Abraham Lincoln.
That depiction that Jim Horton has given us of Abraham Lincoln, I think, merits the word redemptive, that his life, that movement, that as opposed to something like Jefferson, who was tortured, tormented, and perhaps static.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Here's someone who evolved.
And Frederick Douglass would agree with you. In fact, that's what he said.
I thought, in fact, you might be picking Frederick Douglass as the man of the moment. He's someone who had a great influence on Abraham Lincoln. And he's someone, too, who in the 18th, he embodied slavery for the abolitionists. He stood on the pulpit and said, "Here I am. Am I not a man?"
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1850s, he gave a speech that really brought this contradiction home to people. He said, "What to the slave is your 4th of July?"
Well, I pause only because it's a marvelous book, and the points that we're making now are not just true, but very emotional, if you will allow me. Yeah. I guess I want to conclude then with this question, and it's one that is almost predictable and obvious, and that's bringing this into our time. Because it seems to me that this story hasn't ended, that it's a narrative that maybe hasn't really begun. And it strikes me that we're now in an America that's much more complex demographically, and maybe its central story, having never been fully talked through and understood, is now competing with other new forces and things that are arriving and changing the face of the country all the time, which may mean there's some urgency to this. I don't know. So I leave it to both of you to comment on that. You first, Lois, and then you, Jim.
Well, we spoke about the legacy of slavery, and I think we're still trying to work through the legacy of slavery. I think that's partly what the civil rights movement was in the modern civil rights movement. Mm. And you talk about the new people coming. It's interesting. It will cause us, I think, to investigate our histories in a different way. There are points at which the histories of people, say, from Central America and Latin America generally meet our history of slavery. There was slavery there too, so it's part of their experience of the new immigrants coming from those parts of the world.
Yeah, you know, I think it is certainly true that this story is central to America's ability to understand itself. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 1990s, then President Clinton asked us to have a conversation on race. Well, we tried, and I think what we found out was we don't know enough to talk about. And one of the things that we need is a historical context, because this stuff didn't just happen within our lifetime. All of these issues that we're trying to deal with today and we're having trouble dealing with today have a long history. We need to understand that history. And we also need to understand this. Through all of this, and you can read some things that you will never forget these stories. You will never forget these stories and the story of how people resisted under conditions that we can hardly imagine. But you realize in all of that, these people never gave up on America because they weren't focusing on America's reality. They were focusing on America's potential. They were focusing on America's promise. Well, it seems to me what we need to do and what we owe to these people is to push America towards that potential. If it says it believes in freedom, if it says it believes in equality and opportunity for people, we ought to make it operate in that direction, as they tried to.
You can't top that. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guests were James Oliver Horton and Lois E. Horton, co-authors of Slavery and the Making of America. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our assistant producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.